Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first part of the show today is Paul Burnett. He's the Utah Water and Habitat Program Director for Trout Unlimited. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this. Tell us what Trout Unlimited's mission and role is here in the state of Utah. I think Trout Unlimited is such a familiar name. Most people know of it, but may not know what you guys actually do.
Sure. So Trout Unlimited, we're a nonprofit organization. We're membership based, so we have about 1,500 Trout Unlimited members across the state. And our goal in the state is to conserve, protect, and restore our cold water fisheries in Utah. And so we again, because we have members, we kind of blend grassroots conservation with our professional staff. And we try to focus on some priority areas across the state where we can conserve our cold water habitats. A lot of our chapters are based in our major communities across the state, and a lot of us have our home waters, right? The rivers that we fish the most that are close to home, and those are the waters that a lot of our chapters tend to focus on.
So before the show, Chris asked you a great question, which is, does Trout Unlimited focus on fish other than trout, which I thought was an interesting one.
So even though Trout Unlimited is our name and trout is obviously our focus, we look broadly at the cold water habitats across the state, and those cold water habitats bring in a whole range of other fish species beyond just trout. And so, our goal is if we can preserve those habitats and those watersheds, and if they're functioning, properly and providing cold water and fishable water and clean water, then those watersheds are going to provide a broad range of benefits beyond just fishing. And so even though we are a traditionally an angling group, we look more broadly than that, and looking at watershed health and water quality and water supply for all of us.
So cold water fisheries compared to what? The opposite of that warm water.
Right.
What's the difference there? Where do you draw the line?
Well, there's not really a clear line between cold water and warm water. In general, if you look at the origins of our organization, we started up in Michigan where there is a lot of cold water rivers, right, that are really popular for fishing. And so, at some point, we looked at, kind of what our emphasis is, and that's kind of where we started. We look at, we do find the warm water rivers and streams important as well. And again, we try to look at the broader watershed health. Just because we're Trout Unlimited and we're cold water habitats, which is mostly headwaters, small streams, or high elevation rivers, we're not discounting the importance of rivers like the Colorado, the Green River, provide really important water and really important habitats for some pretty valuable fish that are not trout.
Let's talk about trout, because not all trout are native species here in the state.
That's correct.
Right? So run across the scale there of what are native trout and non-native trout.
So in the Intermountain West, the predominant native trout is the cutthroat trout. Mm-hmm. And cutthroat trout are really interesting. The state fish of Utah is the Bonneville cutthroat trout, which occurs mainly in the waters that flow or historically flowed into the Great Salt Lake. So, Weber River, Bear River, the Provo, even the Sevier River in southern Utah. But the eastern half of the state is a completely different drainage basin. It's the Colorado River Basin, and there's Colorado River cutthroat trout in that basin. So so the primary native fish across the Intermountain West is cutthroat trout. And we have these drainage basins that are divided by mountain ranges. And most of those major drainage basins have different subspecies of cutthroat trout. So we actually have three officially recognized subspecies in Utah, and then one that's not officially recognized that in general is being managed separately. So that's the Bonneville Colorado River cutthroat trout. We do have one area where Yellowstone cutthroat trout is native, up in the northwest corner of the state.
Interesting.
And then the Bear River cutthroat trout, which is actually managed as Bonneville cutthroat trout, is actually being considered a separate subspecies. It's much different than the Bonneville cutthroat trout we see in the main Bonneville Basin. So, and you know, one of our emphasis as an organization is we've been working with the Division of Wildlife on a program called the Utah Cutthroat Slam, which is a program where we encourage anglers to go out and catch all four of the subspecies of cutthroat trout in Utah. They can register for the program. It costs $20, and they can get a medallion after mm-hmm. they catch all four subspecies. So it's a great program. It really highlights the value of those native cutthroat fisheries and gets people into waters that they typically wouldn't fish. So
are cutthroats all catch and release, or can I keep cutthroats?
You can keep cutthroats. Okay. Yeah. You know, again, it goes back to different waters have different regulations, and those are determined by the State Division of Wildlife.
Okay.
So each water has some different, generally different objectives for management. So
then there are a handful of non-native trout out there.
Sure.
Brown trout is one that comes to mind because they're so plentiful in our local waterway, East Canyon Creek here. But talk us through some of the others out there and how they got here, why they're out there.
Sure. So there's predominantly three species of non-native trout, exotic trout that are not originally from Utah. And those are and they're all three are pretty popular. So those are the brown trout, which come from Western Europe. The brook trout, which come from the eastern United States, and then the rainbow trout, which comes from the lower Columbia River in the Pacific coast. So those are the three most popular non-native trout. In a lot of our waters, especially waters that are influenced by dams, where you have a change in the hydrograph, you have changes in the temperatures over the years, the brown trout tend to really dominate. They are really well adapted to those environments, but they're also really popular fisheries. So brown trout in some of our local waters can get pretty large, and people really like to catch them. So
But do they compete with other native species, trout or otherwise?
They do. So that is one concern. That's one thing that always needs to be balanced, is that the needs of the native trout versus the value that the fishery value of the exotic species. And so, you know, there's places where the brown trout are, you know, the right thing right now for our fisheries. And there are some places where the Division of Wildlife has been removing some of these non-native fish to make room for native cutthroat trout populations.
Right.
So what kinds of places would see a removal of the brown trout? What areas have been prioritized?
So, you know, we look at, in terms of priority, you know, we look at trying to make sure that the native trout that exist are going to be there long term. And when we say long term, you know, we try to look out hundreds of years with management, making sure that the native fish are still here when the next generation of people come along. And so when we look at the conservation of cutthroat trout, we Trout Unlimited, we really focus on, and we work with the wildlife agencies really closely, but we really focus on what we call the three R's of conservation. So it's resiliency, representation, and redundancy of populations, right? So if a subspecies of cutthroat trout has large enough populations that can withstand threats like fire or floods, things like mm-hmm. that can mm-hmm. wipe out a population. If there's enough populations across the whole landscape, and if those populations have these different what we call life history strategies, like some of them are migratory, some of them live in lakes, some of them live in rivers. If there's that representation, then we think that they're they're in a place where they can persist long term. So that's really where we focus our priorities, is making sure that throughout the range of these cutthroat trout populations, they have all these characteristics, that those populations are big enough, that they live in big enough watersheds, and that they're spread out across the landscape. And so that's really where, you know, the rubber meets the road in terms of, you know, conservation and priority.
So let's change gears a little bit. Sure. And talk about some of the, I guess, the challenges or threats to some of these native species that you see, you know, coming in the next decade, or that those that are already here. What do you think are kind of the biggest challenges for the native trout?
So there's a handful of them.
Okay.
So, and one of the things we see with our watersheds is that as you know, we've built our cities and our infrastructure, our roads and waterways and like diversions and that sort of thing. Those, whenever there's an intersection between streams and our infrastructure, mm-hmm. oftentimes there's what we call barriers to fish migration. So we can use roads as an example. Anytime a road crosses a stream, there's usually the stream is put in a pipe usually, or sometimes there's bridges, but a lot of times those pipes can be shaped in a way so that there's velocity problems, or like too fast a velocity, or there's vertical drops of water that fish can't get through. So fish can't crawl around things. They have to stay in the water. Mm. Some fish can jump, but not all. And so, and the same with water infrastructure, dams and diversions, those all can block fish movement. And so we call that fragmentation. That's a key challenge in our rivers, is when this habitat gets chopped up into these smaller and smaller pieces. And then if you have a fire or a flood and the habitat's chopped up and fish are removed from a section of a watershed, there's no way for them to naturally repopulate. And so that really is a constraint on the fish populations. You overlay that with habitat loss. Look at the Weber River that was really impacted by flood control in the past and the construction of the interstate and the railroad. Mm-hmm.
Some places now it's almost more of just like a channel than a mm-hmm. river, it seems. Yeah.
Yeah. But you go below Echo Reservoir and there's, you know, areas where there's miles of river that are just straight, which is just not. Yeah. And that's one, it's not natural, but also the habitat in that straight reach is just minimal. I mean, it's just simple.
Not places
habitat.
For the fish to,
exactly.
to thrive. Yeah.
So,
well, I'm sorry, let me reintroduce. We're speaking with Paul Burnett. He's the Water and Habitat Program Director for the state of Utah for Trout Unlimited, talking about trout and cold water fisheries in general, the health and wellness of them in the state of Utah. We've got a few more minutes. We wanted to touch on some of the other challenges. So there's physical challenges.
Barriers.
There's also, barriers. There's also chemical and biological including, the sediment, increased sediment runoff, changes in temperature there, perhaps, that you might maybe someone's tracking with respect to a warmer Utah that's happening. But we also talked a few weeks ago about the effects that fire has on trout fisheries, cold water fisheries in general. What's your take on this program that's going on that actually, what we would say, captured cutthroat trout out of a stream down near St. George? I'm trying to remember the fire. We'll get to that. But there was a fire, large fire. I think it was the DWR collected mm-hmm. Cutthroat trout. Now temporarily housing them in a fishery
right.
until that stream recovers. Sounds like a pretty unique process.
The unfortunate reality is that was an important and necessary action.
Yeah.
Right? And that was a reaction to a fire that, I mean, the reality on the ground is that population, that one stream, you know, a couple miles of stream had this really unique population and it wasn't anywhere else. And so, it's a symptom of a couple of things. One, you know, I think you've probably talked pretty extensively about it, but fires are the dynamics of fires right now is changing.
Yeah.
Like they're bigger, they're hotter. You overlay that with climate change and increased fire season. Like, there's some estimates that the fire season is 75 days longer than it was historically, which is pretty nuts to think about that. And that really puts our cold water streams, our cutthroat trout, especially our small cutthroat trout populations, really at risk, because those fires can just blow through those watersheds. So, it's a risky move, and it's you know, anytime you move a fish population, there's always chances that things could go wrong, that you could lose those fish in transporting or more hosting them in a hatchery. So it's a scary situation. I mean, we're definitely supportive of that action. I mean, that was something that had to be done, and they took the right action in that respect. But the broader question is, can we be more proactive about our cutthroat trout populations and making sure that, for example, that population is in more than one stream, right? If it's broader, if those populations are throughout the landscape, one fire may take out a population, which is not great, but the nice thing is we have them somewhere else too.
And well, it's interesting that trout, the future of trout's health and wellness is a function of fire policy in a state too. There's linkages between land-based policy and water-based consequences. So we got
a few minutes. Okay. Yeah. And I wanted to ask, obviously you do quite a bit of work on the ground projects. So I know that you did a huge inventory and started addressing some of these barriers to fish passage. But I wanted to just leave a few minutes to talk about some of the policy work that Trout Unlimited is doing in the state of Utah, kind of taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture. Tell us a little bit about that work that you're doing.
Well, so we're looking at policy in a couple of different areas. One is public land management, and we actually have people on staff that are working pretty closely with our federal delegation and with the legislature at the state level on public land policy. And that's really important for us because, again, the whole idea of conserving our cold water habitats, that most of our cold water habitats and watersheds start on public land. And so that's really, really important to protect those from a funding efficiency perspective. That's, mm-hmm. that's like the best place we can be spending money is protecting the stuff that's there. Right. Mm-hmm. But we're also looking, and we're also working pretty closely, across the state on water policy. If we were talking 10 years ago, I don't think anybody would be talking about, you know, potentially looking at different tools that we could use to, you know, bring in-stream flows into places where we've had some major challenges with water.
Yeah.
And so we're having those discussions. It's really positive. Things really move slowly in that respect, which is good, because, you know, we need to make sure that if we bring new tools into the water policy arena that it works for agriculture, which, I mean, they have most of the water and they use most of the water, but also that doesn't cause some sort of unintended consequence. So there's a lot of different potential tools that are kind of being discussed right now. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll have some legislation that provides us with the different ways of keeping water in streams that are, you know, that are collaborative and not creating conflict. So.
Well, with our own little East Canyon Creek up here coming close to drying up, we'll be looking out for that, and we'll keep in touch with you on that.
Yeah, and I have to say East Canyon Creek this year has been a really good example of how informally the water suppliers have been able to work together to keep just enough water in the stream. In that vein, we are collecting stream temperature data throughout, basically from McLeod Creek all the way down to East Canyon Reservoir. So it'll be really interesting to see what sort of effects different flow levels had on temperature this year. So I'm pretty excited to see that data.
All right. We'll talk about that this winter. Yeah. So Paul, before we let you go, if people are interested in getting involved with Trout Unlimited or helping to volunteer on some of your projects, how can they get involved?
Yeah. So there's a lot of ways for people to get involved. One is, you know, I always have to plug be a member. It's $35 a year. Pretty much every community in Utah has a TU chapter. In Park City, it's the High Country Fly Fishers. They meet monthly. They're a great, great group. So joining them and going to attending some of the TU meetings kind of gives you an idea of what the at the grassroots level what's going on. But you know, a couple things. You know, individually, just make sure you get out, go fishing, enjoy the waters, understand what the issues are, and then bring your experiences to the ideas of understanding water policy and other land management policy across the state, and use that information to help inform our decision makers. I mean, that's really where it starts with the grassroots efforts is making sure that there's that we're all on the same page, that we understand what the issues are, and that we're able to influence the decision makers.
Right. If there's one constant theme that comes out of all our discussions and the interviews we have on whether it's land, air, water, they're all linked mm-hmm. together, and they all eventually impact biodiversity and our ecosystems,
right.
How we act. Okay. Paul Burnett, he is the Water and Habitat Program Director for Trout Unlimited for the state of Utah. Quick website?
You can go to www.tu.org. We also have Facebook pages, Utah Trout Unlimited, and I think we're on Instagram as well. So
why not?
All right, we'll look for you there too. Thanks, Paul, so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks.